Open up your local paper, you'll probably see mugshots of people booked into the county jail, but that can sometimes do more harm than good, especially for the people in those photos. Plus, homeless shelters open for extra hours during the winter. The summer poses its own challenges for people struggling to find housing. And the U.S. Women's National Team won the World Cup for the fourth time yesterday. We'll recap yesterday's final and talk about why you should keep following women's soccer.
The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WNIJ in DeKalb, and WCBU in Peoria.
That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. I hope you had a great 4th of July weekend. And if you're still on a high after watching the U.S. win its fourth World Cup yesterday, we're going to be talking about that later in the hour and offer some tips for folks who want to continuing following women's soccer, especially the Chicago Red Stars, a few of those players on the field yesterday. Plus, when it gets too hot outside, some homeless shelters open up their doors to serve as cooling shelters. We'll hear what that looks like this summer. But first, we wanted to bring you an update on some recent news. According to reporting from WBEZ, last week Governor Pritzker's administration reversed a state policy that made it harder for low-income children in CHIP, that's the Children's Health Insurance Program, to get the measles vaccine. This change follows a 2016 decision by former Governor Bruce Rauner that made it so doctors had to pay for CHIP vaccines up front and then wait to be reimbursed by the state or private insurers. Due to the expense of the vaccine, some doctors stopped vaccinating patients on CHIP. In April, more than 50 physicians signed a letter expressing their concern over the fact that not all kids covered by CHIP were vaccinated. According to a memo obtained by WBEZ last week, the Pritzker administration has quietly reversed the Rauner rule. The move was applauded by physicians and pediatric organizations. Dr. Julia Morbahan is a pediatrician on Chicago's Northwest Side. She told WBEZ's Christian Schorsch that thanks to this policy change, she's going to start providing vaccines again.
We're relieved for doctors that did purchase these vaccines and that had to take on a lot of debt. They were underwriting the policy with their own credit cards, that, you know, they no longer have this financial burden.
Again, thanks to WBEZ for that audio. The U.S. measles outbreak has hit its worst level since 1992, reaching 1,095 cases this year. That's as of last week. There have been 9 cases of measles reported in Illinois so far this year. Scan the crime section of a local paper, you'll probably find a collection of mugshots and booking photos provided by the local police. Some news outlets say sharing the images is a public service and an important aspect of keeping a community safe and informed. They also say publishing mugshots falls under the media's duty as record keepers, providing information on when and why people are booked into jail. But critics argue, including mugshots lacks context and that news outlets don't always follow up on these cases, which can have a serious impact on the lives of the people in the photos. That's what happened to Kevin Hobbs when his mugshot was published in the Champaign News-Gazette at the end of 2018. Kevin is with me now in our Urbana studio to tell us more. Kevin, thank you for being here. Welcome to the 21st.
Thanks for having me.
Glad Kevin, I wonder if you can walk us through what happened when you were pulled over. This was in 2018?
It was the evening of December 4th. I was in a friend's automobile, and I guess one of the lights was out, taillight was out, which I was unaware of, and I was pulled over by the police in Rantoul, Illinois. And once they pulled me over, you know, they ran the plates, they took my license, and then they informed me that there was a warrant out for my arrest, which completely shocked me.
And I mean, I can see your face right now. Your face still looks a little shocked about
yeah,
that.
Yeah, I was completely blown away. And they were looking at the information, and the police officers that I encountered were very respectful to me. I think, you know, they kind of got that this was a really legitimate shock to my system, because I was just like, what is a warrant for what?
And what was it for?
That's the funny thing. It was about an old sanitation bill from Vermilion County from over a decade ago. And evidently, there was a small portion of the bill unpaid. And I had sold this house. It was a house I owned, and I had sold it. And I guess they attributed it to me. And so they had been sending information to erroneous addresses that I don't even know where they got that information from. But this whole time, they were continuing to pursue this. I had no idea this was going on.
How much was the bill?
The bill was only a couple $100.
Wow.
And, you know, they had continued to have, like, court appearances that I had no idea was going on. And so they issued a warrant, and that's what they pulled me over for. It was a small claim. It was literally a small claim they pulled me over for.
And did the police tell you this at the time?
The police said it was a small claim. They thought it was ridiculous that they would have to take me in. But they were very nice. They allowed a friend of mine to come pick up the vehicle. They didn't impound it, anything like that. And on the way to the Urbana jail, they allowed me to use my cell phone in the back of the car because they felt like it was a pretty ridiculous thing. When I got there, they put me through intake, had to unlace my shoes, the whole nine. And
I mean, clearly something like this has never happened to you before, even as you're describing this experience.
No, not at all. I've never been in any kind of trouble or anything like that. And it just it was completely shocking. And so I have a whole bunch of things going through my head because I'm also a single parent. So I'm like, oh, my God, what exactly?
Well,
is
and
this?
You also work in the school district. So
right.
I imagine you're thinking about your job as well.
You know, the only thing I was thinking about was my kids at that point. The job thing had not even really occurred to me. I was in shock. I knew that I could bond out as soon as I got there. But that was really the main thing. Okay, so I have to get back to my kids. So what's going on here? So they take me in, and the process was about 3 hours. I mean, it was 3 hours, and then a couple of the officers that I spoke with, some were like, I don't know about this. They brought you all the way back here just for a small claim? We'll check it out, because they didn't believe me.
Because they thought it was also, they can't believe that they brought you all the way from Rantoul to Urbana. For our listeners who are not familiar with this part of the state, that's about a half an hour drive.
Correct. And so, you know, I sat there and they did some checking. And they came back and they said, wow, I understand why the police officer that brought you in was a little bit down, because they felt ridiculous bringing you in. You're like, I thought you were lying, but you were telling the truth. This is just for a small claim. This is crazy. That's what they said. This is crazy.
So then was it the next day your mugshot from the night before gets published in the Champaign News Gazette?
Right. And I didn't know that. You know, I'd gone to work the next day, and one of my coworkers is like, hey, is everything okay? And I'm like, yeah, why? And so they
That's how your coworkers found out?
That's how they found out.
What did you think when you found out that your mugshot had been published in the paper?
I was furious. I was furious because I looked at it and it was very ambiguous. The title that they had under it, it was very ambiguous. It could have been for anything, realistically speaking. And so they have me stacked up in these other photos with individuals accused of some heinous stuff. And there's my picture. Boom. Profile and everything. And I was furious. And so I sat back and I thought about it. And I felt that the best thing that I could do was to get in front of it. And that's when I addressed it in a very public way on social media, across my social media platforms. I posted the picture. I explained what it was for. I posted the case information and addressed the News Gazette and their practice of posting mugshots without context.
What kind of response did you get?
It was overwhelmingly positive. The funny thing is that one of the things that I hit on was that you do this and it doesn't really serve a purpose other than to just get hits or interest in your website or your news product. But it could be really, really damaging to individuals. And I work with kids. I did get a call from my higher ups about it, and we spoke about it, and they were very understanding. But most people don't really have any kind of experience in handling something like that in a public fashion. My background in marketing kind of lent itself to that, to me being able to say, okay, so this is how I'm going to say, here's my bullet points, and this is how I'm going to just be out here with it. And I got a lot of responses from people who had their lives wrecked from mugshots being published. There was one individual that was in a custody battle and lost custody of their children because their ex-spouse had used that in the court case. Because there was an altercation, a minor altercation. The individual, and I looked at it, they sent me all the information. The individual didn't really do anything. They were just in the wrong place at the wrong time. But that happened at a period where they were going through this custody battle and it was used against them.
We're speaking with Kevin Hobbs. Kevin, thank you for sharing the story. I appreciate it. He's in studio with me and here in Urbana. He's the founder of the Doze Foundation. He's telling us about his experience when his mugshot was published in the local paper. I want to bring someone else into this conversation. Jay Stanley is joining us. He's a senior policy analyst for the ACLU's Speech, Privacy, and Technology Project. Hi, Jay. Welcome to the 21st. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me on.
Jay, so you've been listening to Kevin's story. How common is a story like Kevin's?
Well, it's too common, in fact. It's quite common for local newspapers to print mugshots. There are also websites that scrape police mugshots and publish them. And the fact is that a lot of people who are arrested, some are never charged, many are never convicted. So a lot of innocent people end up having their mugshots taken. And all too many people who see those mugshots make bad assumptions about people. And so, you know, it can be very, very hurtful, as Kevin said, to people in their lives.
And again, it's because of the context here. And I wonder, Jay, are there usually any kind of explanation for the charge? What do we normally see with the format when we see these mugshot kind of photo databases?
Well, it varies widely, but often the photos are not presented with enough context to really give people a fair shake. And even worse, often the sites that publish them do not indicate whether the person was convicted or even charged. And that can mean that individuals have really bad assumptions made about them by people in their communities.
And in fact, I know that last year, two of the alleged owners of an online outlet, you were mentioning this, mugshots.com, were actually arrested and accused of extortion because that site requires people to pay to have their mugshots removed. What can you tell us about that case? Does that happen as well?
So, yes, there are some really, really terrible actors out there. I think that there are local newspapers that are, one might say, journalistically irresponsible in terms of presenting information like Kevin's as if it's of interest to the community, as if it's newsworthy, and profit off of that without being fair to the subjects of their quote-unquote journalism. And I think that, you know, those kinds of local journalistic outlets can and should be criticized in their communities for that. There's another layer of bad actors, which are websites that really do engage in what we would call, at least in everyday speech, extortion. They basically put your mugshot up for the world to see, and they will promise you that they will take it down for a payment, which can reach into the hundreds of dollars. And that is obviously really, really evil. As a legal matter, it probably does not, and there have been lawsuits, but as a legal matter, it probably does not fit the definition of extortion. The fact is that when a public record is made public by the government, there is First Amendment protection for spreading that around, for publishing, et cetera. And so really the point to fix this is with police departments. there's no reason that a police department needs to make public every mugshot of everybody who's been arrested. We have seen, for example, the U.S. Marshals Service has a very nuanced policy where they don't release mugshots unless they think there's a public interest in doing so, for example, to help the public identify a wanted fugitive, or if somebody requests a mugshot, and if the mugshot is requested, they will release it only if it serves the public interest to do so. For example, if there's an allegation that somebody was beat up by the police when they were being arrested, and the mugshot indicates, you know, the extent of their injuries or what have you, there's definitely a public interest in seeing that mugshot.
Jay, I imagine there are people who might say that there's also a public interest in local newspapers reporting on crime. I guess from the ACLU's perspective, would you say that the photo doesn't need to be a part of that? Or what's the ACLU's concern when it comes to this part of it?
I mean, I think that there are journalistic fairness ethics here, such as, is there really a public interest in the public learning about the arrest of Kevin? Or is that just sort of nosiness? But from a constitutional and a legal standpoint, you know, there absolutely is very, very vital interest in overseeing the police department and in understanding what kinds of crimes happen. You know, arrests are public acts, and arrests need to be public acts. We can't have law enforcement or government arresting people secretly. That said, there's no reason that a mugshot needs to be issued publicly as part of that process.
That's Jay Stanley with the ACLU's Speech, Privacy, and Technology Project. We've also been speaking with Kevin Hobbs, who's been telling us about when his mugshot was printed in the Champaign News-Gazette in 2018. We made several attempts to reach out to the News-Gazette to get their perspective on this and respond to these statements. They didn't respond to multiple calls and emails asking for comments. We're going to continue this conversation after this short break. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Welcome back to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. I'm speaking with Jay Stanley from the ACLU in Washington. He's a senior policy analyst with ACLU's Speech, Privacy, and Technology Project. We've been hearing about Kevin Hobbs' story. He's in studio with me here in Urbana. He's been sharing what happened when his mugshot was published in a local newspaper. Kevin, so since December of last year, the News-Gazette has said they're actually going to make changes to their crime reporting, and they've said specifically they're going to do three things. Ensure that crime stories are reported on or followed to conclusion. Decide whether to include mugshots on a case-by-case basis, which they say would likely result in fewer being published overall. And delete mugshots in cases where a person has their charges dropped or is acquitted. But they also said they won't remove the initial crime story because of its importance as a, quote, proverbial first draft of history. What do you think of that?
Well, I think that I would be remiss if I did not bring up this particular publication in the way that I'm about to, because as you can see, I'm a black man. And one of the things that really sparked my interest was I wanted to see how their reporting was across the board. And to do this, I received a lot of links to a lot of information and a lot of pictures of their previous mugshot posting. And the News-Gazette as a whole for the community, just in the course of the last few years, from what I've noticed, hasn't done any favors in their biased reporting. I work within a school district. I work within a school that has a large number of African-American students and students of color. There's been a lot of negative reporting against that school district, unfair reporting, because of changes that have gone on and changes that will positively affect students that look like me, that look like you. Year before last, the only students that were suspended in that school were students of color for exemplifying behaviors that generally all students exemplify, but only the students of color were being expelled and or suspended for the most part. The News Gazette has posted mugshots of individuals who are not persons of color and included the word student. But they'll publish the mugshots for some of the kids that I see every day, and they'll have the charges listed there.
And they don't say that they're students? Or they're they publish, so they publish mugshots of juveniles, of people who are under 18?
They have before. Now, what I've been told, and what I was told on that post that you may or may not have seen that went viral about this, they said it was an algorithm and that it's nothing that they can control. However, algorithms are man-made things. And I'm not a tech genius, but I know that that can be changed. And from what it sounds like, it could have been changed. It just seems like they've come under fire. And so they're starting to give a little to kind of quell that, because the reporting by that newspaper on a whole has been unfortunately quite biased. And when we're talking about people of color, and especially me, we're dealing with a society where the criminalization of persons of color has been at the forefront of just about every single social justice issue. The criminalization of persons of color has been used to advance political ideas. You've seen it concerning Trump and the immigration issue. And this is something that's not just a problem here locally, it's a problem nationally. And I think that, you know, publications like the News Gazette, I think it's good if they're changing, as long as it's real change. But the thing is, they said that it's something that they couldn't control. That was the initial response. Now we're finding out that they can't control it. So I don't know what to believe, because when you were pressed on it, you said, you know, we can't do anything about it. And that wasn't even by a singular individual. They just replied under the News Gazette banner on the post. Now they're saying they can.
So did they end up taking your photo down?
You know, I had not looked for it, because for me at that point, whether it stayed up or whether it came down, okay. I had addressed it publicly. I know I didn't necessarily take it down from the posting I had. It's not something that I'm ashamed of, because it's something that should not have happened in that fashion. And so the one thing I do believe is that in order for me to have control over my future, then I can't be afraid to talk about things that happened in the past.
James, you've been listening to Kevin share this story. When we think about the practice of mugshots, how much disproportionately does it target people of color? And I would think particularly men of color and black men.
Well, we know that it does. We know that black people are more likely than white people to be approached and interviewed and frisked by the police. We know that black people are more likely to be arrested by the police. We know that black people, if they are arrested, are more likely to be convicted. So there is racial bias in every stage of the criminal justice system in this country. And one of the many unfortunate results of that is that more black people are going to have their mugshots published, and serving to, you know, add yet another layer of unfortunate consequences of the racial bias that penetrates our criminal justice system.
So, Jay, I wonder what responsibility the publications have to the people in the photos. Does it depend on whether that person is guilty or innocent when we think about the legality of this?
I don't think, in terms of the legality, these publications, if the mugshots have been released as a public record by the police, they absolutely have a First Amendment right to publish them. As a journalistic ethics matter, they absolutely have a responsibility to the people that they're reporting on, if you can call it reporting. And in many cases, this is just a cheap way to get clicks, I think, by a lot of these sites. But it's clearly unfair to put up a mugshot of somebody who's been falsely arrested, arrested for some nightmarish bureaucratic snafu, like Kevin describes, or the many other circumstances where people do not deserve to be the subject of scrutiny of their communities if they're some hardcore criminal. And at the very least, they should post follow-ups to establish, you know, the outcome of people's cases. But of course, that requires much more work than just automatically posting the mugshots that are issued by the police departments onto their website. So the cost benefit is not there for some of these publications.
And when we're thinking about, in this case in particular, with the Champaign News Gazette, the changes that I mentioned of the things they said they would do, ensure that crime stories are reported on or followed to conclusion, deciding whether to include mugshots on a case-by-case basis, deleting mugshots in cases where a person has had their charges dropped or is acquitted. Do you think that's sufficient, Jay?
I think those are certainly very, very good steps towards more journalistic responsibility. Certainly, if somebody in a community is arrested for armed robbery or what have you, there's a keen public interest in the case. And as I said, you know, police arrests are always public things. But, you know, I think that really the key question here is the policy of law enforcement to release mugshots in every arrest. I think that is where the most productive attention can be paid. Police departments could have a policy in which they don't do that, as I said earlier, and state legislatures could actually pass laws banning police departments from releasing all mugshots willy-nilly.
Kevin, would that be something you would like to see? What would you like to see happen here?
I think that's a good step. What Jay mentioned about actually passing legislation that speaks directly to law enforcement officials and having them not publish those photos. However, I think that to a larger degree, press is power, and those are the images that are put out. And so, yeah, we can say law enforcement's at fault, but the pipeline to everybody's streaming device, so to speak, is the media. And when they publish photos like this, without follow-ups, without retractions, without any kind of care to the individuals involved, in service of the community, these individuals that are in these photos are the community as well. And I think that they are derelict in their duties to report factual things to completion.
So did they follow up with you with your story?
They did not. There was another publication out of Muhammad that spoke with me. I'm speaking with you now. But no, I have not heard anything from the News Gazette.
What would you like to hear from them?
I would like for them to not just hint around changes. And it sounds like that listing is hinting around. It sounds like they're offering a compromise of sorts, so to speak, to quell public unrest, because I'm not the only one that's been complaining about this, obviously. But it's my earnest belief that compromise can be a breeding ground for further oppression. And I don't think that slight changes are going to do anything. We need sweeping changes with how you cover the community that you're within and a part of. It's your responsibility, and to that, it's our responsibility, each one of us, in order to make the community better, the world better, to, as James Baldwin said, imagine ourselves and one another in a much better way. And so if they cared about these people, then that would show in their reporting. That would show in how they respond to it. It shouldn't have taken this long. I wasn't the first time that something like this has happened. But I was maybe one of the only ones to speak out right around that time, or knew how to do that. Everybody can't. And so it's wonderful to have people advocating for them on their behalf, but a slight change here and there is just not going to cut it. I mean, we have to change how we see one another. And I think that's the basis of it. And the News Gazette and individuals that are involved in this particular portion have to change how they see people in their community. When you see someone that's of color that's been arrested, you can't just throw it on the woodpile, so to speak. You can't throw the picture on the woodpile. And you see someone that's not a person of color be arrested, well, let's do a background check. There's some good reporting on a lot of those. Student, this age, and they tell the story as a kind of a buffer. You know, a public buffer. And, you know, it's just imbalance. So if the system is broken, then just do away with the system. When this went down, I had a friend that knew an attorney out of the Chicago area, and there, you know, there aren't any really good laws in place that can protect individuals who've had their mugshots published. But I would say to anyone to not be afraid to kind of make this happen in the court of public opinion. Just don't be quiet about it. Talk about it. Find people that have gone through it. Make noise. And the winds will begin to change then.
As you guys are sharing this story, I'm just thinking of I got a ticket once in California when I was at NPR West, actually, ironically, for I wasn't even jaywalking. I was walking in the street, but the crosswalk said don't walk. And I walked, and a police officer in his car pulled me over and gave me a ticket, and which I thought was like ludicrous. But I was like, OK, it's California. So I didn't pay attention to the ticket because I was living in Florida at the time. And 6 months later, I got a letter from California saying they had issued a warrant for my arrest because I hadn't paid the ticket and they had doubled it. And I was just like, now that I'm thinking about it, I'm like, wow, this could have happened to me if I hadn't, you know, there would have been a warrant out for my arrest. There was a warrant out for my arrest. So I paid the ticket.
You know, when you said that, it made me think about one other thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to be the one to go deep and down to the depths, but I have to be realistic about it. As a black man living in America, the more times that I am pulled over or stopped by the police, it directly correlates to my mortality rate. And that's deep, and that is heartbreaking, but that is the truth. And for issues, I mean, we've seen in the news, we've seen it played out time and time again, individuals have been killed that are people of color. When they haven't even done anything, driving down the street, things of that nature, being pulled over. And so I think at this time, it is something very, very serious that law enforcement and the legal and justice system has to consider when these warrants are issued. Because as a black man, when I leave the house every morning, I have to think about how I portray myself. I have to think about how I'm going to say what I say, how I'm going to publicly process my emotions, knowing that it could mean the difference between losing my job or losing my life. And W.E.B. Du Bois talked about the two lives that we have to live. There's who we really are and who we can show within the framework of this American experience in order to be safe. And those things can't get lost. The humanity of the situation, the gravity of the situation cannot get lost in all this. And I think when that does, that's when we have systems like this.
Thanks for sharing that, Kevin.
One thought that this sparks is that, you know, Kevin's experience might sound like it's some sort of freakish bureaucratic snafu or what have you, but what we learned from the Justice Department report into Ferguson is that the police there in Missouri were using this kind of technique as a fundraising mechanism for local governments. They would target the mostly poor and mostly people of color communities there for nickel and dime them with minor transgressions, minor violations, and then suck them into the criminal justice system through an escalating series of fines, arrest warrants, et cetera, and really criminalize normal people. And so, you know, that unfortunately in some communities in this country is the way that business is done by law enforcement. And it's really fortunate that Kevin, the police officers who dealt with Kevin were respectful and didn't seem like maybe that was what was going on there. But there is that larger reality in other places in some parts of this country.
Oh, that was going on there because they turned that $200 bill into like $1,000. It's just that I wasn't dealing directly with Vermilion County law enforcement.
Right. And if you had not been able to pay that $1,000 bill, you know, it would have just escalated further. And that's what I think what happened to a lot of people in Ferguson, according to the Justice Department report there.
Kevin, thank you for sharing your story. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Jay Stanley has also been with us with the ACLU's Speech, Privacy, and Technology Project. Jay, thanks for taking the time to speak with us as well. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on.
Again, just a note to our audience, we did reach out to the News Gazette multiple times to try to get their response to this conversation. They did not respond to us. Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Nyla Boodoo. During the winter months, many homeless shelters open up their doors for extra hours to keep people safe from the cold. That's less common during the summer, but some shelters will still offer cooling shelter space when the temperature gets too hot. And one group is advocating to have an emergency shelter open throughout the year for people struggling with homelessness. That group is See You at Home in the Champaign-Urbana area. Rob Dahlhaus is its executive director, and he joins us now. Hi, Rob. Welcome back to The 21st.
Hi, thanks for having me back. I appreciate it.
So, Rob, I know we're in the middle of the summer, and this week it's not dangerously hot, thankfully, but at what point do you all decide that you need to open cooling shelters?
Yeah, great question. So, generally, we've got a policy where, you know, if the temperatures feel like triple digits or if there's a heat advisory in effect for the area, then we'll go ahead and open up. Some extra hours. Generally, those are, you know, morning or early evening. So that's kind of what we've tried to do over the past couple of years in order to protect our friends when it gets really, really hot.
And a cooling shelter is just a place that's air conditioned?
Correct. So we've got a daytime drop-in center actually here in Champaign that we operate. And so we try to have, you know, cold water. Obviously, air conditioning is running. The benefit of that type of facility as well is that it's staffed by a licensed clinical social worker. We have one of those on staff, and also we've got three members of our outreach team who have been through drug and alcohol addiction recovering guys, so they're able to provide a good perspective for our friends as well. So while the folks are there staying cool, they're able to come in and get some resources as well.
We're speaking with Rob Dahlhaus, Executive Director of See You at Home. And Rob, I wonder how often you find folks needing your services in the summer versus the winter. I think it's often when we talk about dangerously cold temperatures, people are aware that it's life-threatening. Do you have the same amount of people who handle dangerously hot temperatures in the same way?
Yes, absolutely. I think that's a common misconception, you know, especially in central Illinois, the dangerous cold in the wintertime, that comes fresh on your mind, but the heat can be just as deadly. So many of our friends suffering with mental health issues or substance abuse issues, and if someone is intoxicated during the day, they can become dehydrated actually, and if they happen to pass out, you know, in the heat, that can be just as deadly. So one of the other resources we provide through the outreach team is our guys are going out in the community, you know, checking on the places where we know our folks are at, whether that's, you know, in the parks or, you know, downtown, wherever that might be, and bringing water, bringing Gatorade. We're blessed by a lot of folks in the community donating water and Gatorade to us, so we're able to make that personal connection while also making sure folks are staying safe.
But, Rob, I think just as people may not be aware that the dangerous heat poses as could be as life-threatening as the cold, people might also not be aware of the seasonality of shelters. What does that look like in central Illinois for when winter closes in terms of what's open and what's available for people?
Sure. So right now, unfortunately, we do not have a year-round men or women's shelter in Champaign-Urbana. We haven't for quite some time, well over a decade. Currently, there are some housing programs, some transitional housing programs, but those are not emergency shelters. You know, you think of an emergency shelter, a place to stay that night, you know, when law enforcement encounters somebody at 2 in the morning, where do you take that person? And so right now, for the last 3 winters, we've had a men's emergency shelter that has been operated by local faith community and the connection with the United Way, See You at Home as well. And that's really been a powerful collaboration to see come together. And then Austin's Place, the local women's emergency shelter during the winter, is coming up on their 13th winter season being operational. So they've been around for quite some time. Like I mentioned, our goals right now are to get those services year-round, trying to figure out what that might look like. And for See You at Home, we are in the process. We are actually taking on the men's emergency shelter under our umbrella of services this winter with the goal of having that be year-round at some point in 2020.
And Rob, I imagine, is this a resource question in terms of the sustainability of this? Is it a space question or both of those things?
You know, frankly, the safety part of it, I believe we have those issues taken.
Oh, I said space, actually, not safety, space, Rob. Just the physical space.
My apologies. No, the space issue, as far as the men's shelter goes, is not an issue right now. We've been blessed. We moved into a new facility back in September. It's the former Times Center building, if you're familiar with the, you know, Champaign-Urbana area. 70 East Washington is the location, and we actually have a large dorm area, so space, not an issue there. Funding and resources, I would say, is the main issue right now. We recently relaunched our monthly giving campaign, the Hope Givers, in an effort to get 400 entities, individuals and businesses involved at $40 a month. And if we were able to do that, we would actually be able to fund the shelter fully year-round. We're estimating anywhere between $190,000 and $200,000 annually to run a resource like that. And so that's what we're calling out for the community to get involved.
Rob, is this a problem throughout the state? I imagine there might be a year-round shelter in Chicago, but what about for the rest of Illinois?
Yeah, good question. So there are some resources like that in other places in Illinois, matching Charleston area, Chicago, Springfield, those types of cities. But in Champaign-Urbana, we just haven't for quite a while. And I think there's funding issues. You know, there's prioritizations with state and federal funding and kind of the best practice, quote unquote, to solving homelessness. For CU at Home, we're 100% funded by the community, and we'd like to stay that way. And bringing this resource on with emergency shelter, we'd like to continue that. Those are some of the things we're battling with right now.
That's Rob Dahlhaus, Executive Director of CU at Home. Rob, thanks for taking the time to speak with us. I appreciate it.
I really appreciate the time. Thank you so much.
For the fourth time, the United States of America are crowned champions of the world, and for the very first time, they've done it on European soil. It is finished at the Stade de Lyon in the final, in victory and joy for the United States.
That's John Helm calling yesterday's World Cup final for FIFA TV, and the U.S. women's national team are now back-to-back World Cup champions. The U.S. beat the Netherlands 2-0 and won their fourth World Cup overall. By now, you've probably heard the names Megan Rapinoe, Alex Morgan, Julie Ertz. The team has gotten the world's attention, and in 4 years, the U.S. will be going for a three-peat. But there's no reason to wait until then to keep watching women's soccer, especially since many of these players are going back to their professional teams to finish off the season, and we've got four World Cup players you can see right here in Illinois because they play for the Chicago Red Stars. Sandra Herrera is a soccer writer and co-host of the Chicago Red Stars podcast, Southside Trap, and she joins me now. Hi, Sandra. Welcome to the 21st. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me.
So, Sandra, I wonder if we can start with yesterday's game. The U.S. had done a pretty good job of scoring early in the previous matches, and I have to say I was a little nervous with the first half, the score still being 0-0. What was different about how the Netherlands were able to defend against the U.S. in the first half of the game?
Well, for the Netherlands coming out, they appear to have changed up their tactics. They usually played in a certain style throughout this World Cup, sort of rotating midfielders, they call it a dual pivot. And they had changed things up in an effort to obviously play up against the United States. And it appeared to have worked for about the first half, maybe even the first 50, 60 or so minutes of the game. We saw something similar with the United States when they played against Spain during their knockout rounds. But eventually, like the United States has shown throughout this entire tournament, they ended up figuring things out and came away with the victory.
Right, and that began with Megan Rapinoe's penalty kick, where she scored. And I think for people who, if they didn't know who Megan Rapinoe was in the past 2 weeks, they've really learned about her. How good was she this World Cup, Sandra?
Unreal, honestly. I think the narrative surrounding this United States women's national team heading into this World Cup wasn't so much about one particular player. There was a lot of discussion about the depth of their team and how how valuable all of their players were, from player one to player 23. And if there were players that were sort of pegged as possibly having big tournaments, I don't think it was Megan Rapinoe. I think maybe people were pegging somebody like Alex Morgan or Tobin Heath, a young player like Roosevelt, who made a huge and tremendous impact on the tournament, but maybe not so much Megan Rapinoe for all she did on the pitch and off of it as well.
Right, and she did have that second goal as well, right? So in terms of thinking about the younger players. Sandra, can I ask you, this team has drawn attention to the pay gap between men and women, and it's a really stark pay gap when we think about the difference between how much the American men are compensated versus the American women. One analysis from The Guardian found that the women's team is set to earn World Cup bonuses that are 6 times less than what the men paid, even though the women have won 4 World Cups and the men didn't even qualify last time. So, Sandra, obviously this is something that you follow really closely. Is this kind of old news for you? Do you feel like this is maybe a different conversation this time around because of attention the team has gotten?
Personally, yeah, for someone who covers the sport, it is old news to me. But, you know, that's the thing about World Cups. The platform is just, it tends to be a little bit different in the sense that it's much bigger. It's a global stage that everyone is watching. So these issues, these things that these players and this team have sort of been fighting for, advocating for, are much louder, right, when they're under these types of lights. So we essentially witnessed, yes, a very historic win, a back-to-back, never done ever in U.S. women's soccer history. But, you know, we essentially had a team that went out there and overperformed. There were some doubts out there. The level of competition has risen for some other teams, specifically in Europe. And there were some people out there who thought that it would be an incredibly difficult role for the U.S. women's national team to go ahead and continue to achieve as they have in the past. So this team had openly, you know, sort of not totally gone against their federation, but has been open in terms of having lawsuits against them and speaking out against the gender pay gap, and essentially just went out there in spite of the federation and continued to be successful. So as far as maybe something like this not being so new, I think for someone like me, people who are followers of women's soccer or report on it and write on it, definitely are ready to maybe move on with the conversation. And hopefully something like this will
really call attention to it. And I want to ask you about that attention. I'm speaking with Sandra Herrera, who's co-host of the Chicago Red Stars podcast, Southside Trap. Sandra, when we're thinking about the Red Stars, we've got 4 World Cup players who play on the Red Stars. What can you tell us more about the team? What's your favorite thing about the Chicago Red Stars?
My favorite thing about the Chicago Red Stars probably is just honestly, it just comes down to the players and sort of who they are as encompassing as a team. They're a team that's been around for many years. They've sort of integrated themselves in and out of various, you know, women's professional soccer leagues. NWSL, the National Women's Soccer League, isn't the first pro women's soccer league in this country, but it is the longest running. And the Chicago Red Stars have, you know, been part of various, you know, prior professional women's teams. So just the longevity.
Yeah, Sandra, I wonder if people wonder how, like, people might not even know how good they are. Like, when we think about the team, and especially we think about the momentum that the women have coming back now from the World Cup, how good are the Red Stars when they compared to their counterparts across the country?
They have a pretty storied history. They're a team that have found themselves in the upper table of the NWSL for the last 4 years. They've made the playoffs for the last 4 years consecutively. That's something that no other team has done. You know, they've got some of the best talent in the world. You've got, like you said, they've got 4 Red Stars players returning from the World Cup that are now champions, and Julie Ertelis, and Mayor Turner Davidson, and Morgan Bryan. And they also have Sam Kerr, who's one of the best strikers in the world who played for Australia and also represented in the World Cup.
Great. So the season goes, as we're saying, the season runs until October. If you want to catch them, you can in Chicago. Sandra Hernandez is a freelance soccer writer and co-host of the Chicago Red Stars podcast, Southside Trap. Sandra, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks to Sandra Herrera for joining us there. And that's all the time we have for today. Tomorrow, Black Americans have long faced disparities in the healthcare system across socioeconomic status. And we'll learn tomorrow about how independent Black-owned pharmacies are closing that gap by providing culturally competent healthcare. That's tomorrow's 21st. Tune in to the show for that. If you want more information about past shows or this show, you can always go to 21stshow.org. That's our website. We are a production of Illinois Public Media, and I'm Nyla Boodoo. We'll see you back here tomorrow. Thanks for listening.